This is Desha from the Science Media Center. I'd like to welcome all of you to our briefing on sustainable mining. Scientists weigh in. A few housekeeping notes. I'd ask that you please hold any questions you have for our panelists till the end. And I will also be muting people who've dialed in during everyone except for the presenter. I'll mute you during those presentations just to minimize the noise on the line, and I'll open it all up at the very end. If you do want to raise your hand, as it were, you can use the chat box that you see in the upper left corner to indicate that you have a question, and I can call on you during the Q&A session at the end. When speaking, please introduce yourself and your organization when you are introducing your question. So, to get underway, this has been a very topical and controversial issue. Mining, which is currently proposed on conservation estate, the debate has become quite polarized. The Science Media Center felt that it would be useful to bring in some people who've done research in this area and who can offer their perspective. So I would like to introduce our three speakers today. We will begin with Dr. Gavin Mudd. He is a lecturer in environmental engineering at Monash University in Australia. He joined Monash in 2003, but last year in 2009, he was at the University of Auckland as a visiting research fellow and looking at this particular issue, issues associated with mining on conservation land, so he has quite a bit of knowledge in this area. His research interests include sustainable mining, environmental management and impacts associated with mining, and rehabilitation of mine wastes. Our second speaker will be Professor Dave Craw. He is a professor of geology and also the chairperson of the Environmental Science Board at the University of Otago. Dave Craw has research interests in the field of mineral deposits, particularly gold, and also environmental issues related to mining. He runs a program on environmental effects of mining, which is focusing on heavy metal mobility in historical mine sites. His current specific projects are focused on arsenic mobilization around gold and coal mines in Otago and mercury mobility in Otago and Northland. He's worked extensively on conservation land in New Zealand on these issues. Our third speaker will be Professor Anton Meister, Professor of Resource and Environmental Economics at Massey University. Dr. Anton Meister has kindly agreed to join us on this controversial issue. He has very diverse research interests that are focused on environmental policies and natural resource issues, such things as fishery management, sustainable land management, allocation of water, carbon trading, and many others. He's worked in both developed and developing countries, and his research examines the role of benefit cost analysis and non-market valuation in evaluating these kinds of policies and programs. So, I will now hand over to Dr. Gavin Mudd to begin our briefing.
Okay, thanks, Desha. Let's get this technology going. Okay, my name's Dr. Gavin Mudd. I'm from Monash University over here in Melbourne, but I've been following a lot of mining issues, I suppose, mainly around Australia, but also New Zealand and elsewhere. So what I want to try and do is cover some of the, I suppose, the risks and issues that we need to think about when we're looking at mining, you know, wherever it occurs, but also especially when we're dealing with high-value, lands like our conservation lands. Now, I think in Australia, of course, we have a rather laconic sense of humour, but I thought this is actually a rather old little cartoon that I use quite often in mining issues, but it basically documents the conflict, the very difference, significant differences of opinion that occur between the values of land, whether it be for national parks or for mining or for other uses. Also, I often use this quote as well because we often think that a lot of the issues we're dealing with in mining are new, when in actual fact they're not. If you look at Agricola, Agricola is often considered the father of the modern mining industry. He was the first person in Europe to really document mining, smelting, and debate the use of metals and whether they create net benefit or the impacts they create. But he did acknowledge that mining can leave significant impacts, and that legacy can actually last for a long time. We know that the Tinto region of southern Spain, where we derive the name Rio Tinto from, that name is derived from Red River, which is basically a testament to the long-term pollution that was caused by the old Roman mines of the day. So we know that these issues can last sometimes hundreds of years or sometimes thousands of years if we get it wrong or if we don't manage the environmental impacts and risks appropriately. So I think Agricola, although he was arguing overall that there was greater benefit from mining in the fact of improved agriculture, better standards of living and so on, he did acknowledge that there were environmental impacts. Those environmental impacts led to social impacts, but also for some things, some metals, they also actually increased our ability to make war and other things like that. So part of that debate, I suppose, is in these days we'd call that the debate around sustainability, but very interesting to note that it was alive and well 500 years ago, let alone in 2010 in New Zealand. So if we think about mining versus conservation, then in a lot of ways it really is an old debate about which way we manage land, which way we use land, the types of resources that we extract and from land. In Australia, of course, that debate is still ongoing. We have the Ranger Uranium Mine, which I'm heavily involved with in terms of providing advice to the traditional owners or Indigenous people there. And the industry certainly argues here that environmental management, modern environmental management, can actually allow conservation and mining to coexist. And I put a question mark next to Ranger because I don't think the court has settled on that one yet. I think the only way we'll really be able to judge the outcomes of Ranger is when we come back in 50 years' time after the mine is closed and we've done the rehabilitation and we're confident that the rehabilitation has worked. I'm much more cautious about predicting the long-term benefits of or success of rehabilitation. And you'll see a bunch of photos as to why I maintain that caution. Now, the other view, which of course is often the sort of the environmental view, is that mining can present major risks. And we know we've had major tailings dam failures this century, as well as a number, last millennia as well. So, and some famous ones, you could mention Baia Mare in Romania that led to fish kills and significant impacts in Eastern Europe. But also you could go to the Omai tailings disaster in Ghana, or that the Octedio Grassberg in Papua New Guinea and West Papua. So a lot of these things, there are big risks that we do need to manage. And for a lot of people, of course, those risks are incompatible with high-value conservation areas, whether it be Kakadu National Park, the Coromandel Peninsula, or elsewhere around the world. Now, I thought I'd put some of these slides in because we often hear in mining that it's just a simple matter of finding more, producing more, and so on. So I wanted to sort of really put a little question mark out there of what we really see is the ultimate sustainability of mining, because if we think historically, we've always said, well, that's the way we've always done it over the past 200 years, therefore we can always do it for the next 200 years. And I think ultimately that's wrong. I think we cannot extrapolate the patterns of the past and just blindly believe that they're going to be a good patterns for this millennia. The industry globally is suffering from declining ore grades, but also quality. The nature of different ores are changing and therefore making it much harder to process. And sometimes those impurities may be things like high phosphorus iron, which is a big problem in the Pilbara in part. Other aspects may be mercury say, gold ores or things like that that are not what you're targeting in terms of, say, gold ore, but it's certainly something that you want to be looking at in terms of understanding the difficulties around processing ore. We are finding it harder and harder to maintain economic resources, and even in big mining nations like Australia, that's proving to be the case. We're suffering from increased tailings and waste rock, and you'll see some photos later on about just the sheer scale of issues that can cause. But also we know that we're having to spend more energy, use more water, input more chemicals and so on, and we're getting larger pollution outputs, especially greenhouse gas emissions. Now, if we look at the energy intensity of mining in Australia, it's gone up about 50% per dollar value over the last 25-odd years. So in that sense, so despite the boom, yes, we're producing more, but it is getting harder. And so macroeconomic indices such as energy, but also assessments of productivity, are also all showing now that it's getting harder. The whole issue around peak oil is going to be a fundamental challenge to mining, which I don't think has really been thoroughly addressed yet. So we could look at all of these types of things, and at the same time as we're trying to deal with climate change and greenhouse gas emissions and actually reduce, say, our contribution to anthropogenic climate change, we're trying to increase demand that's coming out of, meet increased demand that's coming out of China or India. But we also can't forget the other big continents that are yet to hit the development streak, such as Africa and South America and so on. So these are no small challenges. These are big issues. So this is just the data from Australia, and again you could discuss each little series individually, like the initial discovery of copper in the 1840s, the gold rush from the 1850s, the discovery of Broken Hill and so on, the long-term march of coal mining. But again, that trend in the grey arrow line there, that long-term, effectively exponential growth, is something that I think we need to be mindful of. And you could apply some simple statistical regressions to these and extrapolate them out for 50 to 100 years. And every one of those resources would be effectively gone within the next 50 to 100 years. So in that sense, it's not just a matter of how much we've got left. It's the cost of getting it out of the ground, because clearly the way we've done it in the past is not necessarily the same way we can do it this century. Now, I mentioned the decline in ore grade. This is data that's actually out there, and it's not hard to compile. It takes a bit of effort. But we know that if you look at, say, lead, you've got a long-term decline, same with copper, zinc, gold, etc. So therefore, if we want to meet increasing production, we've got declining grades, which means we have to dig up more and more and more rock, which means more and more and more tailings, which also often means, if it's open-cut mining, incredible amounts of waste rock and so on as well that we have to manage. So in that sense, we have to be mindful of a lot of these sorts of factors where we are starting to hit the wall. Now again, this is the trends in waste volumes. And we can see that this is an old mine that closed down in 1971. Now, the Mount Oxide mine, it's not far from Mount Isa, it closed in 1971. But this was a photo taken in 2009. Now, this is not to say that every mine would be like that, but that's the acid mine drainage that we're seeing. Now, any good chemist can look at the colour of that water and realise and probably guess with reasonable accuracy what the copper concentration is likely to be. And we know that it's over 1,000 times higher than enough to kill fish. So in that sense, that waste volume that we're getting in the mining industry now in Australia is fundamentally huge, and that is radically different to the way the mining industry used to be, say, 25 years ago or 100 years ago. And that legacy that we're leaving to future generations is something we need to account for, so that we don't leave these types of long-term pollution risks to future generations, such as we can see either in Europe, as Agricola debated, or from the Tinto region of Spain and so on. Now, I mentioned also greenhouse gas emissions and so on. Now, if you look at this graph, this is from some sort of work on track with gold mining. We can see on the bottom where we've got the gold ore grade, and we can see that most of the world's gold mines are dealing with a few grams or several grams per tonne. And the difference in terms of greenhouse emissions, like how many tonnes of greenhouse emissions or CO2 does it take to produce a kilogram of gold, we can see that depending on the electricity source for individual gold mines, we can see that there's a significant difference between gold mines that are sourcing their electricity from hydroelectricity versus ones that are sourcing it from coal or from diesel and so on. Now, part of that scatter is, of course, not every gold mine's the same. A lot of gold mines are actually quite different in their configuration. Some have open-cut mines, some have underground, some have a very large throughput in terms of ore, some have a very low throughput. Some gold mines also use a carbon in pulp plant, others a heap leach and so on. So there's a lot of variability in there that helps to explain some of that. But essentially, we can see that the carbon footprint of gold mining is very sensitive to ore grade. And if we know that ore grades are in terminal decline, then we're only going to be moving to the left on that curve, or i.e. upwards in terms of our CO2 footprint. So if we are going to meet increased demand, we're going to see a much faster rate of increase of our carbon footprint than just the increase in production alone. That's something we need to be very mindful of. But, last year, when I was in Auckland, I was invited by the local community to visit the Martham mine at Wahi, and with Newmont, and acknowledge their hospitality in hosting a mine site tour for myself and a number of people from the community, and the Greens as well. And I mean, these are some of the challenges that we've got to balance in terms of whether it's looking at the impacts of, say, mining on townships like this. And this is not a unique situation. It's, in Kalgoorlie, there's a very similar situation, but on an even bigger scale. And so we've got to manage issues, whether it be dust, whether it be noise. Also here, there's subsidence issues that have to be managed. But also the tension between a community that was looking forward towards closure and a company and a gold mine that's actually trying to look to extend its operations. So there's genuine issues there to try and manage. Now, if we look at a nearby mine, this is Golden Cross. Unfortunately, the animation hasn't quite worked, but Golden Cross is basically an old mine. It only operated for around about 10 years. It was rehabilitated almost 10 years ago when it closed. And when I visited there back in August last year, you can see ongoing acid mine drainage. But also, what you can see is there's still some slope failures and in the open cut there as well. And so, although this the site looks green so much, it's still not a site that we're comfortable with. It's left no pollution legacy and no pollution risks going forward. So it's something I think we need to be mindful of. And as I pointed out with this little media article, it's these issues are not just unique to one site like Golden Cross. It's there's many sites across New Zealand that have this legacy issue to deal with, and that's the sort of risks that we're leaving in terms of mining into the future. Now, can we rehabilitate? Well, sure, we can do a lot of things much better than what we used to, and we certainly are required by law to make sure we rehabilitate. A lot of the legacy issues we're dealing with are from a previous generation of mining, like Tui, where the requirements weren't as stringent as they are now. I like Golden Cross in that sense because it is an instructive example where Golden Cross was rehabilitated under the under modern stringent environmental regulations. And yet we still have not got to a point 10 years later where we're comfortable that there is no ongoing risks or legacies associated with that site. So it's an open question mark, I guess. Now, I thought I'd put some photos here of the Ranger Uranium Mine, and again, the animations I had in here haven't quite sort of come up the way I would hoped. But 3 years ago, in late February, early March in 2007, the Ranger Uranium Mine, which is surrounded by the World Heritage listed Kakadu National Park, it suffered around about 800 millimetres of rainfall in less than in about 2 to 3 days. One of the most intense sort of storms that had actually gone through that region in probably over 30 years. And it was only a tropical low, it wasn't even a cyclone status in terms of its storm. But the risk that it presented to the region, and we could see the South Alligator floodplain on the bottom right, and we can see what it's done to the bridge there in the top right. But the engineered water management systems were at the absolute limit, and it was, I think, in some ways just luck that the site did not lead to an accident or a failure. In other ways, it's also partly due to the fact that because of the stringent requirements, they were able to actually withstand such an event, which is, depending on how you look at the uncertainty surrounding a statistic, something of the order of about a 1 in 2,000 year event. So compare that to other mines in Western Queensland last year in early 2009, where they had 750 millimetres spread over 6 weeks, and nearly every mine actually had an overflow event, where sometimes there were tailings that actually escaped out and failed. In other areas, there are actually heap leach solutions of copper-rich sort of solutions of very acidic waters reaching for 50 kilometres downstream in the creeks and rivers downstream, say, from the Lady Annie mine, which led, obviously, to significant impacts and so on. So a lot of these sorts of risks, that's the daily gamble that we often take in some of these sort of areas, and it's... It depends on which way your view is as to whether you could say, well, it's successful or whether that eventually you keep taking that sort of 1 in 2,000 year risk or 1 in 10 year risk. And eventually, like Lady Annie last year, after 2 years operation, you get a big accident. So these are some of the risks in, I suppose, in examples from Australia where you have to be mindful of these sorts of issues. So in that sense, whichever way we manage land use is always going to be complex. If we've got national parks or conservation zones, we still need to manage those lands very appropriately. Now, mining also presents major risks, and part of those major risks are also just the whether it be the energy and greenhouse issues associated with mining, and that's getting harder. So those intensities are going up over time. The mine waste that we're leaving to future generations, and whether we've rehabilitated and successfully addressed the risks associated with that mine waste, and so on. So in a lot of ways, in Australia, when we're looking at the question of what is the net benefit, I think it's a big question. And certainly, as released yesterday, our tax review is proposing a new tax on mining to actually help deal with some of the benefit sharing in terms of economics. I think I wish we'd be a bit broader than that and actually include some of the environmental costs as well as just looking at the economic revenues that can be generated. Because if we're looking at a 50-year-plus history, or future history of mining, then I think we need to be looking at ways that we can find that value. And in a lot of ways, that value, I think, is going to be increasingly found through things like recycling and so on, where if we stick to dinosaur technologies like coal mining, then I think we're only going to be digging Australia into a further hole. So a lot of these sorts of things, I think, are really a matter of political perspective. But I shall leave it there, just some acknowledgements. And I'll pass it on to the next folk. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gavin. I see that Kent has a question. We will save that to the end. I will now move on to Dave Craw of University of Otago.
Oh, yeah, g'day. I'm quite impressed by the talk we've just had, and I'd like to add a little bit to it from the geological perspective. Just starting off by saying that I'm pretty neutral on all of this, but I think that there will be mining in the future, as the previous speaker has talked about. There will be quite a lot of mining. There will be large amounts of waste. And if we want to keep our society going the way we do, and there's no sign that people will want to change that, then we're just going to have to live with that somehow. And the sorts of research that Gavin's been talking about is the sort of thing that we're going to have to do much more seriously on into the future. I just want to talk about the details, I suppose, of New Zealand mining and point out that we have two main commodities. We actually produce iron ore as well, but not to anywhere near the same extent that Australia does. But we do produce a lot of coal, and there's a lot of misinformation in the media, I think, about that coal. It's incredibly high-quality steelmaking coal that we produce there, and the coal that's being mined from underneath Paparoa National Park now is that high-quality steelmaking coal. And I don't think we have a proper alternative to that. We send it overseas, very large amount of it, and it comes back, obviously, as in my slide there, it's Toyotas. It doesn't have to be Toyotas. People drive other things. But that's the main source for our steel. Most of the steel that we use is Australian iron ore, and a lot of it is New Zealand coal and Australian coal that goes to help to smelt it. The New Zealand coal is actually a little bit of Trans-Tasman rivalry there. The New Zealand coal is actually higher quality than Australian coal for that purpose. And a lot of the New Zealand coal is blended with more inferior coals because the New Zealand coal is so good. The other stuff that we produce particularly well is gold, and we've been doing that for well over 100 years, 150 years. And just to put the conservation land perspective on that, I've got a slide up there showing historical view of gold mining near Reefton. And behind the gold mine, you can see the remnants of deforested hillsides, and they really did trash the place in those days. Now, in the ensuing 50 to 100 years, the forest has regenerated without any help from people, because we didn't have regulated mining in those days. And so in the main colour picture, you can see that the forest that has regenerated there, that's at the moment been interfered with by the new gold mine at Reefton that started in 2007. And there is an active process, of course, now with regulated mining of rehabilitating that site. I take Gavin's point about how successful that rehabilitation will be. Certainly as far as the trees are concerned, that shouldn't be a problem. Whether there'll be a legacy is another matter. I'm not sure about that. And we need to have ongoing work done. Just to take a step over to Coromandel, and this is very similar to what Gavin's been talking about. The Coromandel area has a similar history to the Reefton area. The main difference is political, and it was a point that Gavin made right at the end of his presentation, is all these decisions are political. There's not a lot of science goes into these decisions, and I'm quite surprised about that. But that seems to be the way that things are done. So, for some reason, the Coromandel area, which was extensively cut over and mined historically, in the same way that Reefton was in the previous slide, Coromandel went into Schedule 4, and Reefton didn't, which is why there's now a gold mine at Reefton and not at Coromandel. Now, eventually, there will be much more pressure to go back into the Coromandel. The reason seems to be that Coromandel gold deposits were richer than the South Island ones, and the gold is much easier to get out. So from the energy point of view that Gavin was talking about, he made an excellent point there. The gold is much easier to get out of Coromandel ore than it is to get out of the South Island ore, the Reefton ore, or Otago. So just as an outside observer, I have a suspicion that that's why the mining industry is quite keen to get back into Coromandel. It's, from a political point of view, it is essentially the same as conservation land on the west coast, but for some accident of history, the Coromandel area was put into Schedule 4. Now, I just want to make a point about time in the mining industry. There seems to have been a lot of talk in the mining industry somehow that in the media, that the mining industry is going to pull us out of the economic doldrums. I think that's a pretty unlikely situation. The slide I put up now just makes a few points about the timing of mining industry. Mining is a very long-term industry, and it's definitely not a quick fix for immediate economic problems. In New Zealand, getting a mine started can take about 10 years, especially if it's on conservation land. There's a whole lot of non-conservation issues that come up, like metal prices or commodity prices in general. But 10 years is a pretty standard sort of number. Now, in the next 10 years, because we've got such a strong history of coal and gold, my view would be that it's pretty unlikely we'll have mines other than coal and gold starting up in the next 10 years. We just have an industry with an impetus. The other commodities that get talked about quite a lot in the media, in other parts of the conservation estate, it's pretty unlikely that anything like that would be up and running in the next 10 years. I think it's more like 50 or 100 years. So that's getting a mine started. And then the mine operation itself, and Gavin has given a very good overview of what mining is like when it's actually going on. It can be quite ugly, and that's just the way it is. If you dig a big hole in the ground, you take the trees off, and it's a hole in the ground. So that goes on for 10 to 20 years or thereabouts. But even without any human input in most of the conservation areas in New Zealand, the regeneration is phenomenal. It's quite spectacular, the amount of regeneration that can happen. So that on a 50-year timescale, mining is largely invisible. Yes, there are issues with things like acid rock drainage and so forth, and these have to be seriously managed. They're major issues. But there is a big difference between what was going on in the past, which was largely unregulated, and what we know now. There's a large amount of information that's coming out, and Gavin's been talking about quite a lot of that. So we know what to expect. We know what the issues are. We can identify most or possibly even all of the risks, and then it comes back to political decision, of course. And then the economic benefits. The economic benefits of mining carry on for quite a long time, 100 years or more. I think that the economic benefits have been played down quite a lot by the anti-mining lobby. I think they're rather better than people have been saying there, because of the increased economic activity that starts around mining areas. And certainly if you talk to any of the small towns or even large towns near to mining activity in New Zealand now, I think you'll get a very strong positive message that mining does have economic benefits. Whether they outweigh the negative aspects is another matter, and again, that comes back to a political decision, rather than a scientific one.
Dave, I just want to, this is Data from SMC, I'm just mindful of the time, and
yes.
Request that we can just keep things moving through on as far as the slides. We still have quite a fair few to get through. Thanks.
That's fine. All right, well, I'll try and flip through this one as quickly as possible. It's a complex one, but I think it's important to keep in mind when We're talking about the reputed reputed mineral value on the conservation estate. There's been very large numbers of billions of dollars thrown around as value of minerals on the conservation estate. And this diagram, it looks complicated, but the words in black are the official words that we're allowed to use from a legal point of view when we're talking about mineral resources and ore reserves. And I just want to draw the distinction between mineral resources, which is something that geologists deal in, and ore reserves on the right, which involves a whole lot of mining, metallurgical, economic, environmental, legal issues. So the big numbers that are being bandied around in the world are what are called inferred mineral resources, and they're basically intelligent guesses by geologists, or at least guesses by geologists. That's the present knowledge. Whereas to make a mine decision involves a huge amount of extra information. So we're not even in the proper box for most of the conservation estate. We just do not know how much there is there. The value of the New Zealand mineral estate has been put at something like $150 billion, and it's a reasonable sort of number, but it could be 50, it could be 500. We really have no idea because we're dealing with inferred mineral resources.